The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world, and we speak with those people who try to make our world a little bit more just and a little bit more compassionate. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us this week, and it is the week of the 4th of July. Now, I always get a little bit intrigued by the way we think about holidays. We usually think about them as we get close to them, and once they're done, we kind of move on to the next thing. But we're still within a few days of the 4th of July, so it is a time in which we kind of do think about all the things related to Independence Day. And we also kind of really now are in the midst of summer, and depending on where you are in the country or in the world, it's a little bit warmer or a lot warmer or maybe not so warm, depending on how things are going in your part of the world. So today, as we kind of continue to think a little bit about Independence Day, we're going to speak about what's going on in our world with regard to voting, what's going on with regard to participating in the public debate. And we're going to speak in a little while with Catherine Peters, who is the co-founder of Democracy Works, which is an organization which tries to increase civic participation and kind of uses technology to do that. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Amber Goodwin, who is the founding director of Community Justice Reform Coalition, and an organization which seeks to put an end to inner city violence and killing, and takes a big perspective from a woman's perspective. Interestingly, the letters spell out of her, one of her organizations is Lipstick, ladies involved in putting a stop to inner city killing. So that's what we're going to speak about. And tragically, it's a little bit important that we continue that conversation, because at least in the New York area, and unfortunately, I bet you there are examples throughout the country. Just this past week, we had another example of seemingly a random, unprovoked killing of a police officer as the police officer sat in their van just in the middle of the street. There was no interaction, just somebody from the street walked up and shot and killed one of the police officers who were there. So it unfortunately continues to be timely to speak about how we reduce killing, and particularly in our cities, but throughout the country. So that's kind of what we're going to be speaking about today. And I'm delighted that we have as our first guest, and I think we'll go to our first guest right now, Catherine Peters, who is the co-founder of Democracy Works. Catherine Peters, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thanks for inviting me.
Great.
It's a real pleasure to join you today.
Well, I am delighted that you are with us, particularly since this is kind of the week of the 4th of July, Independence Day. And I suspect that your involvement at this is wanting to get people more involved in American democracy and exercising their rights to participate and exercising their rights to vote. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Democracy Works. Why did you decide to found it?
Yeah, I was actually a graduate student studying how we talk about democracy and how we promote it abroad when one of my classmates came to me and said, I would like to build a reminder system about elections. I keep missing opportunities to vote for process reasons and not knowing that things are happening. And I told him I thought that would be easy. These are famous last words in, I think, almost every startup story. That it would be really great to send text message and email reminders to voters so they know when their mayoral election is coming up and when the school board is getting elected and all of those races that you can miss because they don't saturate your television screen in the same way as the big federal elections. And that was about 7 years ago. And since then, I've had a lot of reason to learn why it's really hard to know when local elections are happening and why it can be tough to tell people how to get registered to vote when the rules are different in every state, and the ways it can be hard to know whether you should go to the polls or request a ballot by mail, and the different obstacles the voters run into. And over the course of the last 7 years, then, we've built out a system called TurboVote that started out as those reminders and has become a full-fledged voter service platform that's capable of helping people get registered, helping them decide if they want to go to the polls or request an absentee ballot or vote early and make those choices intelligently and then be able to go out and cast their ballots in all of their elections.
So tell us a little more. How does TurboVote work? I know TurboTax. I know other turbos. But how does TurboVote work?
It's a really simple online service. It lives at turbovote.org. And as you sign up, we start by asking, you know, who are you? We'll build that relationship. What's your name? What's your nickname? What should we call you? How do we keep in touch with you? And where do you live? And once we know where you live, we know what the rules are. And we can walk through and say, well, all right, are you registered to vote? Are you not sure? We'll help you get re-registered. Are you? Great. Tell us where. We'll tell you about what the options for voting are in your state, and we'll let you sign up. And from there, you'll just get a pretty low volume of reminders that come up when an election cycle comes around, so that when you've, you know, gone out in November of 2016 and you cast your ballot and you felt really like you were involved in the conversation that day and you were really taking part in decisions facing our country, that you also remember and have that opportunity, say, the next April when it is the county hospital trustee instead.
And how far down do you go into elections? Do you go to school board elections? Do you go to town elections? Or how far down do you go?
We absolutely cover county and municipal elections, and we're working to add school boards and individual city council districts and things like water boards and even mosquito abatement districts, where we can find the geographic information we need to know which people live in each of those districts.
So about how long has this been going on? I know you said you founded it probably 5 or 6 years ago. When did you get it off the ground, the actual kind of platform?
We built a prototype that we used on the campus of Boston University in the 2010 midterm election. And then 2012 was really our first year of full-blown operations providing TurboVote as a service to voters nationwide.
And does one subscribe to it? One signs up for it? You register? What? Yep. How do you do it?
Absolutely. It's a free, simple sign-up. It takes about 1 minute.
Okay. And how many people do you have registered?
A bit over 1 million right now.
Wow, that
it's
seems pretty good.
1.2.
And
it's great. It's wonderful serving voters.
And do you have any sense of those million, how many of those were regular voters before they signed up, and how many just kind of got into it through this platform?
It varies a lot because we don't tend to reach out to voters directly. I think one of the things that's really important and that we don't talk about enough in American democracy is how much people need to be invited in. It's a pretty momentous thing to weigh in on your representatives and to help decide common policy. And so many people grow up having that instilled, right? It's your elementary school teachers who tell you how the checks and balances work and tell you what your role in that is. And you feel like it's your responsibility. But everyone has their own path in. And so we try very hard to find partnerships with organizations that can reach people who otherwise don't have as clear of a path into voting in elections. And so we work a lot with colleges and universities who are taking freshly minted 18-year-olds, and they're bringing them in, and they're giving them a lot of lessons in critical thinking and liberal arts and living independently, but also now civics. And we worked this last cycle with Univision, which was bringing in a lot of naturalized citizens and others who hadn't gotten that same sort of shared background in some of those traditions, and making sure that they were invited into the process and really thinking about how casting a ballot could be part of their experience as an American citizen. And so I would actually say that a significant portion of the users that we serve are new voters, and that we're helping give them confidence and information that they didn't otherwise have to be able to take part.
We're speaking with Catherine Peters, who's the co-founder of Democracy Works, which is a project which, kind of in my simplistic terms, tries to increase voter engagement and participation in elections. And it's appropriate that we're doing this during the 4th of July weekend. Catherine, how would you kind of compare or contrast Democracy Works and TurboVote with, you know, kind of the classic voter registration drives?
Absolutely. I think that voter registration is always an important thing to do. A voter registration drive can be a really great way to pull people in. What can happen traditional voter registration drive is that you get someone onto the voter rolls and then they run into a different process problem. It's that election day falls on a day where they're working a 12-hour shift and they can't actually get away to the polls, or they end up with poor weather or trouble figuring out how to get transportation to the polling place, and they don't know what their other options might be for having voted earlier, for having voted absentee. And what we really try to do is walk a voter through the entire process as much as we can, so that they don't just get registered, but they also know what's going to be on the ballot and have a chance to do some Google searching and look up the candidates and think about their choices, but also then making sure that we get them to the moment of casting their ballot in whatever method works best for them. So that's the major difference.
So when we look at kind of voter registration now, we look at voting now, you know, we hear terms now more often than I remember hearing about early voting, absentee ballots, those type of things. Give us the lay of the land throughout the country about how prevalent is absentee balloting? How prevalent is early balloting? And kind of what's going on in that part of the landscape?
Absolutely. So these are additional options for being able to vote that many states are adding and that are increasingly popular. I think it's important to think about the fact that elections aren't on Tuesdays for a totally arbitrary reason. It was chosen to try and make taking part in elections really simple and straightforward for citizens of the 18th and 19th centuries. You needed to have your Sunday clear as your day of rest and a day for church activity. You needed to be able to let people travel to the county seat, which sometimes would take an entire day, so you'd leave them Monday for travel. And then you'd be able to let Wednesday and Thursday still be important market days that you didn't want to disrupt for commerce. So Tuesday was picked to try and make elections accessible to the people who took part in them. These days, that's just not as true. And so options like early voting that allow Saturday ballots to get cast in certain places. Colorado has experimented with voter service and polling centers where there will be multiple places across a county that a voter can choose whichever one is most convenient rather than a single polling place that they have to go to that's assigned to them. States like Oregon and Washington mail every single voter a ballot at the beginning of the election cycle, and then they're able to return it through the mail or to a drop box, and so it comes to you. And I think some of these experiments are really promising ways of thinking about how we keep that initial promise of having chosen Tuesday to making voting a thing that people can participate in easily. And they're all really interesting, and they have their various benefits and drawbacks, but many states are trying to think about how they bring elections back to their voters where their voters are today.
Do you have any idea, just kind of globally, in, let's say, the recent election, presidential election, how many absentee ballots were cast?
Oh, that's a number well into the millions, but I would actually have to dig into my copy. The Election Administration and Voting Survey actually just came out last week.
Okay.
And I haven't had a chance to dig through it. It would absolutely include that number, but I don't know it off the top.
Okay. Because I think there were about 130 million votes cast in the presidential election, I think. I'm sorry, no. Was it that? Yeah, I think that's about what was cast.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to me. But I suspect the number of early votes, the number of absentee ballots is growing, no matter...
It is.
Yeah, and...
The trend is definitely increasing in that direction, that voting on Tuesday is less preferred, and where you give people alternatives, they absolutely are using them and using them enthusiastically.
And how are we doing as a country? I mean, you know, you always hear people lament there's not good civic participation, there's not good understanding of the issues. How do you think we're doing as a country?
In terms of voter turnout, actually, we are not doing very well. Other developed democracies almost uniformly have a higher voting rate than us. When you compare national parliamentary elections or national legislative elections, which are the easiest thing to compare as apples to apples across countries, we come in on par with about Nigeria.
I assume Nigeria is not number one.
No.
Okay.
No, we're somewhere about two-thirds of the way down in terms of participation internationally. And so we have also done better in the past. We have seen 80% turnout in elections sort of during Reconstruction as we were coming out of the Civil War and deciding how we were going to rebuild the country and what the shape of it was going to look like. There was a period where there was a lot of interest in elections and in government and in policy. And actually what we've declared as Democracy Works is that we'd like to be able to return to that and really see 80% be not a high water mark in American history, but the norm. That's really what it would take to be able to say that we have a diverse and representative electorate helping weigh in on the important issues of our day.
We're working
with our partners and with our external groups to put together a coalition that could actually make a moonshot towards 80% participation possible again.
We're speaking with Catherine Peters, who's the co-founder of Democracy Works, which is an organization, I might even say a project, to try to increase the participation and awareness of the elections and in voting across the United States. So, all right, Catherine, you've kind of moved in this direction, and you know, the goal is to kind of make 80% the norm. We're not there by any stretch of the imagination. What do you see, having done this for a number of years now, what are some of the obstacles, and why do we have not such a high participation rate?
Well, thankfully, the Census Bureau actually polls non-voters after each election and asks them why they didn't vote. And I know we talk a lot about apathy when we talk about elections, and that gets answers. About a quarter of people will say things like, because my vote doesn't count, or because I really didn't think there was a good choice on the ballot. But most people will answer with process obstacles. They'll say, I forgot to update my voter registration after I moved, or I didn't know I needed to register, or problems with getting to polling places and issues there. So we focus strongly on those issues, and in addition to building TurboVote, as we've learned what some of those barriers look like, we also work directly with local election administrators to help them build better tools to engage with their voters and overcome those obstacles. We're talking with them about how to take tools that one elections office has built to help ensure that their polling places are compliant for voters with disabilities and share that across other jurisdictions to make everyone's lives a little bit easier and to make sure that they're all able to serve the voters as best they can with limited resources.
Well, you know,
and then the last piece is information. People don't know that elections are happening, which we've talked about, but they also don't know what the choices are on the ballot or how to really think about navigating the decisions in front of them. And so we also do work with the Pew Charitable Trust and with Google to power the Voting Information Project so that people can be able to look up their ballots more easily. They can be able to know where their polling place is.
Well, you know, it seems to me that, and you know, as somebody who has generally voted in most elections, every now and then I've missed an election, but for the most part I have voted. It is really, I would say, appalling to me, and I voted always in New York, but it's appalling to me the state of polling places. And again, I am sure, and this is the Catholic Channel, I am certain that those who are manning those polling places will have a much higher place in heaven than I will. But I don't think any of them are going to be competing for Rhodes scholarships. I mean, it just seems to me the lack of capacity of people to just do simple things at the polling places is appalling to me. And in this day and age, that we're still dealing with so much paper, I just find it absolutely preposterous when you can order anything you want online, you can buy airplane tickets online. Why are we in such a dismal state of using the most rudimentary form of technology to enable us to vote?
That's a very good question. And actually, what I'd say is that many jurisdictions are moving away from that, that New York City is a place that still uses paper poll books, but that tablet-based e-poll books have become really popular in many parts of the country and do make it easier. It's much, much simpler if you can look up a voter on a simple tablet and be able to have custom instructions for what that voter needs for your poll worker, so they don't have to have memorized the entire rule book and all of the customizations. You can go ahead and program more of that in. You can take those people who, as you said, have certainly earned their accolades for being willing to take that day and to go staff a polling place and simplify the process for them also. And that's really taking off. I think the big problem to adoption here is also just funding, that we don't put a lot of money into running elections. We don't think that it's a place that we want to be invested in. And so to be able to put e-poll books across New York City is an investment that just hasn't come yet.
I mean, it seems to me, I mean, if I can e-file my taxes, why can't I vote from my mobile device or from my computer. It seems to me there's enough security built into to filing my taxes that you could build in enough security to make sure that you kind of minimize the possibility of voter fraud.
I think we're making progress towards that. I do think that elections have a higher need for security than even tax filing, because if hackers are able to take bank account information, and they do it regularly. We see this on the news about credit cards being stolen from big box retailers every few weeks or every couple of months. We have good security protocols for being able to roll that back. The credit card companies are able to cancel transactions and cover those, and we know what happened. When you have to keep a ballot secret, there's a moment where you've disconnected the person whose vote might be interfered with from the person who cast it for the purposes of our own privacy. And that makes it harder to be able to roll anything back if things do go wrong. It makes it harder to track what happened. And I would say that in elections, we effectively have a zero tolerance policy for any kind of tampering or fraud, whereas in financial transactions, a small amount of that is something that we can take for granted and continue to have the system run, because it's so valuable to us to have that convenience that a small amount of loss is worth it. So yeah. I understand why voting from your phone isn't here yet. I do think there are some really smart people working on ways to get there, and it's a really interesting future project to be making progress on.
Hey, well, listen, Catherine Peters, co-founder of Democracy Works, thank you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love on this Independence Day week, and thank you for what you're doing, because it certainly seems to me that the more we can kind of push ourselves to get that higher level of voting, the better off it is for all of us. It kind of makes sure that we're all paying attention and that we're all trying to kind of do our part. And it kind of reduces the possibility of just a small group or a smaller group kind of determining elections. So thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with your project. And thank you for undertaking it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for being a voter.
Great.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Catherine Peters, the co-founder of Democracy Works, a project that seeks to raise awareness and, even more so, engagement and participation in elections. This is the 4th of July week. I know we're looking back at the 4th of July, but we're still in its shadow. And thank you for being with us on Just Love. We're going to take a break. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. This is Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is the 4th of July week, even though it's in our rearview mirror. A lot of barbecues, a lot of picnicking, and a lot of warm summer weather. Our first guest today was Catherine Peters, who is the co-founder of Democracy Works, and a very important topic. How do we get more people to participate in our elections? And their goal is to get us back to the high point. And the high point is probably over a century ago, in which 80% of voters were voting. And today we're considerably less than that. So that was our first conversation. And we're going to speak a little bit later on in the show about the issue, which is tragic, the issue of urban violence. And we're going to speak with Amber Goodwin, who is based in Washington, D.C., and she's with the Community Justice Reform Coalition. And she's going to speak particularly about the work of Lipstick, Ladies Involved in Putting a Stop to Inner City Killing, which is a community-based peer-to-peer educational organization that informs women and girls of the danger of gun violence, that Amber sits on the board of that organization. So, Tom, what do you have as for some news items for us?
Sure, Monsignor. Well, I guess the first was late last week, back on June 28th, the U.S. State Department issued new guidelines to American embassies and consulates on applying a limited travel ban on foreign visitors from predominantly Muslim countries. There's six of those, Monsignor: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. The enforcement guidelines began on Thursday, June 29th. And the guidelines, as our listeners may remember, follow the Supreme Court decision that was issued earlier that week to allow part of the Trump administration's revised travel ban to move forward, while also imposing certain limits as the court prepares to hear arguments in October on the scope of presidential powers in this area. The Supreme Court in its decision stated the travel ban could not be imposed on anyone who had a credible claim of bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. And they went on to say that wasn't yet defined by the court decision, but the Trump administration then did define that. They said the close family member was defined as parent, including parent-in-law, spouse, child, adult son, adult daughter, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, sibling, whether whole or half, and included step relationships. But then they went on to say the close family did not include grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, brother-in-law, sister-in-laws, or extended family. So under existing law, Monsignor, Americans may petition for immigration visas for immediate relatives, which are parents, spouses, children under 21. And other relatives may be granted immigration visas with a ranking preference, and the visas are subject to numerical limitations. The bona fide relationship with the U.S. entity, according to the Trump administration, has to be formal, documented, and formed in the ordinary course rather than for the purposes of the executive order.
Okay, Tom, thank you. So let me talk a little bit about that issue. So what basically happened is kind of the Supreme Court said both yes and no. It said, yeah, you could do some of the travel ban, but no, you can't just do it for people who have a real legitimate relationship to either somebody or some business or some organization in the United States. So if there is that legitimate relationship, then even if you're from those countries, you can get in. So the Supreme Court said, okay, that's what the deal is. You get half a loaf, you don't get all the loaf, etc. Now, I'm not going to, at this point, talk a lot about what we think about the travel ban as a whole or things like that. I'm just going to speak about the one aspect is that bona fide or good faith or real or legitimate relationship, family relationship. And what's intriguing, and Tom spelled it out a little bit, is that the administration, which had to issue regulations and guidance to the embassies about it, chose to say, well, here's what we think a close relationship is. Now, I do think it's intriguing by a couple of one particular fact. The first guidance they gave out basically said if you were a fiancé, you weren't included. So a fiancé wasn't included as a legitimate bona fide relationship that got you into the country. Then they went back and said, nah, wait a minute, hold on. Fiancés count. Well, what that says to me, something really, really important. It says that basically the administration has a certain amount of discretion in how it's going to interpret the notion of a close bona fide relationship. And they already made some change. So what I want to call this is my 4th of July barbecue discretion. Okay? Because I want everybody to kind of think about their 4th of July picnic or barbecue or their neighbors or etc. And I just want to know what would happen if your grandmother lived nearby and said, you don't count. You can't come in because you're not a legitimate member of this family. And what would happen if you couldn't have your cousins over to enjoy the barbecue? Well, I kind of think that I want to call this the 4th of July Independence Day picnic exception or discretion. Where I think we just look around and who was considered family at the 4th of July picnics and barbecues. And if they were considered to be legitimately part of the family, that they got a hot dog, they got a soda, they got a beer. Well, I think that's a close enough relationship where we should kind of consider those as part of who kind of gets it. Now, remember, they still got to do all the other stuff. They got to have a legitimate reason for coming, all of those type of things. But I think I want the administration to now exercise what I'm calling the 4th of July picnic discretionary act and include grandparents, grandchildren, cousins in this. And, you know, they could do a little bit more, but I want to begin at least by that. So anyway, that's what's been going on. It's a very important issue. The Supreme Court will take it up in the fall. It's not over. And I think, as I said, there's a lot that could be said about the travel ban in general. I don't want to talk about that. I just want to focus on this one little part about my 4th of July picnic discretion in grandmas, grandpas, grandchildren, and cousins being part of that close family relationship. You know, and I just have a hint. I just kind of believe that I think our nation would be safer if we had that broader definition of a close family, and I think we'd be better off as it. So anyway, so let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to kind of continue our conversation. This time, we're going to look at the tragic issue of inner city violence. This is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us this week. This is the 4th of July week. In our rearview window, we've spoken a little bit about civic engagement. And now we're going to talk about a part of kind of the summer that is not always so pleasant. It's we're talking about that part of the summer, about how sometimes the summer gets violent, and our inner cities sometimes are quite violent. And how do we deal with that? And what are some of the groups that are trying to deal with the violence that are in the summer? So we have as our guest now Amber Goodwin, who is the founding director of the Community Justice Reform Coalition, to speak about some of those issues. Amber Goodwin, thank you for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. I hope you had a good 4th of July.
Yes, I did. Very relaxing. Yeah.
Good. That is that's great. So, Amber, give our listeners a little bit of a sense of yourself, your history, how you got to be part of this coalition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was born and raised in Texas in a very small town called Midland, Texas, and I have spent around the last 16, almost 17 years.
But you got a lot of oil there, don't you? A lot of oil in Midland.
Yeah, there is a lot of oil, especially where I grew up in Midland. Yeah. Oil and high school football is what we have in Midland, Texas.
Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I spent about 17 years working mostly as an advocate inside Congress and inside state legislatures, and really hadn't thought about gun violence as an issue that directly affected me. I'm African American, I'm a woman, and I had never really been touched by gun violence. But I started working for former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly's organization a couple of years ago, doing gun violence prevention policy work, and then transitioned into last year starting the Community Justice Reform Coalition. So we're a national coalition of organizations, individuals, leaders, really working at the intersection of both gun violence prevention and mass incarceration. For a very long time, especially in this country, in America, we've kind of separated a lot of the kind of challenging parts of talking about violence in our country. And so for a long time, it was just talking about guns or just talking about perpetrators of violence and just talking about law enforcement and not necessarily talking about a lot of the intersections between all of these different intersections like policing and things like that. So we try and tackle a lot of those issues, both on a policy and organizing front. We work with cities, we work with law enforcement, we work with organizations and individuals, and really try to make sure that we are centering the people who are most marginalized in most communities, which for the most part, especially on gun violence, ends up being people of color and people in the African American community.
So tell me about Lipstick.
Yeah, so Operation Lipstick is an organization that I've been on the board with for probably about a year and a half now. And it's an organization that has existed for, I would say, I think over almost a decade, just in theory, and then I think in organization probably for the last 5 or 6 years. But the organization really does work to, similarly to CJRC, to make sure that there is a purpose and also a influence behind finding out where a lot of the trafficking of guns, especially in communities of color, have come from. We do a lot of different campaigns, including to expand awareness around shooters and the system of gun trafficking, also making sure that women and girls are empowered to not be straw purchasers, which a straw purchaser is somebody who knowingly buys a firearm for somebody who couldn't legally do it for themselves. And so if you look at a lot of the data and statistics, depending on where you're at in the country, but in a lot of urban areas, when you think about the trafficking of firearms, many times there are women who are traffickers of firearms. And so we try and make sure that we're helping to intervene before people would think about being a trafficker of firearms.
Okay, so let me ask a question, which is always, sometimes it gets to be very partisan, but so let me phrase it in this way. I really think you know, this is my own personal opinion. I think we could use a lot tougher gun control legislation. I think we could use a lot more of that. I'm not a lawyer. I happen to think that any state militia that wants to buy guns, let them buy a gun. But I don't know that Second Amendment should apply to every individual citizen. Like I said, my opinion, and I understand the Supreme Court decision. But having said that, I kind of think we should have tighter gun control laws. There's a part of me which says, okay, that's only a really part of the solution. Because there are like millions of guns out there. And even if we prohibited every new gun, there are lots of guns out there. So there must be more than gun control if we're going to control gun violence. What do you think? Is there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, as somebody who, you know, used to walk the halls of Congress both as a staffer, but then also as an advocate, that for so long it has been a very structured argument that most of the gun laws that our country has been trying to pass, I would say probably at least since the 80s with, you know, kind of the Brady laws and background checks and different things like that, that it has been a very kind of one-sided argument of that we need stronger gun laws. And one of the, I don't want to even say counter arguments, but one of the things that we want to imagine, especially as, you know, people of faith and people who believe that this is a moral argument that we need to be having within our communities, that we also need to first do no harm. And sometimes whenever we think about the harm that mass incarceration is to people of color and making sure that a lot of the laws that we're trying to pass both on a federal and state and local level aren't leading to mass incarceration and specifically in communities of color. And so a lot of the targeted violence reduction strategies, as they're called, have been shown for decades to work both in evidence and in research. And so there have been people of faith and researchers, data scientists, you know, epidemiologists, people all across the board, scientists who have really been looking at the small population of people who are most likely the perpetrators of a lot of the homicides and gun violence, and specifically in urban communities. And so a lot of these strategies kind of evolved from Operation Ceasefire, which was around, in the 1980s in Boston. And there was another strategy around Cure Violence that also kind of spurred in Chicago. And what we found, especially in the last couple of years, and by we, I mean CJRC, and then we also work very closely in partnership with the PICO Live Free campaign, so working with congregations across the country, that, you know, a lot of the kind of stop and frisk strategies and law enforcement heavy strategies weren't necessarily working in our communities. And so really building partnerships with clergy, community leaders, policymakers, local service providers, and really making sure that the full community focuses its attention on the tiny number of individuals who are responsible. So a lot of these violence reduction strategies, again, Operation Ceasefire type